epic fail in Greece.
The country appears headed for new elections after political parties miss a deadline to form a coalition government.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, May 15th.
Coming up, a profile of the new president of France.
A conversation with the CEO of an American company that's doing so well, it's opening a new restaurant almost every other day.
And the professions with a 0% unemployment rate.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The word today from leading politicians in Greece is that the country is headed for new elections after the political parties there failed to reach an agreement on a coalition government. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard is here now with the latest. Stephen, what do we know at this point?
Well, the president says there will be another meeting tomorrow to form a caretaker government, and there will then be fresh elections, probably on June 17th. And it's not surprising the euro has fallen as a result. The opinion poll suggests that the anti-austerity left-wing group Syriza will emerge as the largest single party in the next election. That makes a disorderly Greek default much more likely, and it makes it more likely that Greece will exit the euro, with potentially dire consequences for the euro and for global financial markets.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London, and we'll get back to Stephen in a moment for more on France's new leader.
But first to Tampa, Florida, where there's a J.P. Morgan Chase shareholder meeting going on. Not a great time for CEO Jamie Dimon to face shareholders, given the $2 billion trading loss he announced last week. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Bank shareholder meetings can be raucous affairs, with activists protesting foreclosures and investors pressing management changes. Analyst and J.P. Morgan shareholder Gary Townsend says news of the bank's trading losses will only make things harder for CEO Jamie Dimon.
What was announced last week has provided a bit of tarnish to his reputation, and of course there will be those that try to take advantage of that.
Townsend doesn't expect Dimon's job to be in jeopardy, but banking analyst Nancy Bush says she hopes shareholders will press for more information about what Dimon knew about the bank's risky trading and when.
We need to see bank shareholders come out of their coma and start demanding answers of these CEOs.
Shareholders will vote on executive pay packages at the bank, including Dimon's, but Bush says most shareholders voted before the trading scandal. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
And for more on the J.P. Morgan meeting, let's bring in Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, the chief investment officer at J.P. Morgan has already retired this week after that loss was announced. Do you think Jamie Dimon is at risk at this point?
Oh, no. Maybe some power sharing, maybe a personal pay penalty to show good faith to the shareholders. His public statements were so properly tuned. Outrage, disgust. It was all designed to curry a sympathy that he was let down by his really trusted lieutenants, and heads will roll. But will they pay back the piggy bonuses to J.P. Morgan shareholders? No. But I've got a solution. Defer those bonuses for 3 years. Give it time to see if those genius moves really work.
Defer the bonuses to make sure that people are thinking in the long term as opposed to the short term. And Julie, let me ask you the other question. What about new regulation? It seems like there are more calls for new regulation on Wall Street right now as a result of this, but Wall Street firms always do seem to get around that.
Oh, this time it's likely that parts of Dodd-Frank will go through. It needs some revisions that can't be implemented, but the Volcker Rule definitely is out. It will be going forward. It's forbidding trading, hedging, speculating with depositors' money, and that will go through intact. We need to bring back the old Glass-Steagall Act, which kept banks from doing exactly this, and it kept them safer. We can't let the banks game the system. So regulation, it's coming.
Julie Neiman, analyst with Smith Moore & Company, thanks as always.
You bet.
We're just a few days away from the biggest Silicon Valley initial public offering in history. And in advance of its IPO, Facebook has raised its target price for shares from at least $28 to at least $34. Most of those initial shares will go to big investors with connections. But Marketplace's Bob Moon reports the rest of us do have a chance to get in on the ground floor, albeit a slight one.
Facebook is taking the unusual step of including online retail brokerage E-Trade to its list of underwriters. That and offerings from other retail brokerages will give their customers a shot at getting shares at the issue price. Even so, Southern California investment advisor Robert Pagliarini is skeptical.
You can put in a conditional order saying, I'd like to buy X number of shares. That doesn't guarantee that you're actually going to get those shares. It's a conditional order.
Brokers have posted terms to qualify for Facebook's IPO shares. E-Trade requires a 50-share minimum. Fidelity customers need $500,000 in brokerage account assets and at least 36 trades in the last year. What's a Facebook fan to do? Joe Mager is senior analyst at the Motley Fool Investors website.
You could go ahead and, you know, express to your broker that you'd like to try and get shares. Odds aren't that you probably won't get them.
Not to worry, says Pagliarini. Investors could learn a lesson from Google's IPO.
I mean, there was plenty of opportunity to buy into Google after the IPO and after the pop of Google. So you don't have to be in on day one.
In fact, he says investors might even be better off waiting out the euphoria. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
There's word this morning that the Consumer Price Index was flat in April. Lower gas prices helped there. Also, retail sales in April moved up, but just barely, with warm weather shifting purchases to earlier in the year and sales at hardware and clothing stores down. But as Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports, there are some exceptions to this rule.
During the depths of the recession, a lot of people accustomed to shopping at Macy's and Bloomingdale's stepped for maybe the first time into discount stores like Ross and TJ Maxx. But then as the economy began to improve, a lot of those customers stayed. Ronald Friedman is a partner at accounting firm Markham LLP.
People who got used to shopping in the TJ's and the Ross's, it's amazing you find the same labels in those stores as you do in Macy's.
Why those labels are there has to do with what's happened in the back room. Again, during the recession, the upmarket stores had a lot of merchandise lying around, not selling.
A lot of stores who are looking to get rid of excess inventory, you know, Ross and TJX are the best channels to do it through. They're kind of a good resource for everybody to pass through inventory at better pricing.
That's Jamie Katz, a retail analyst for Morningstar. When parent company TJX releases its first quarter earnings this morning, she'll be watching whether it will hold on to its growth and whether being frugal is still in fashion. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
In an economy recovering from a housing collapse, it's probably not easy being Home Depot. The chain reported weaker than expected quarterly results this morning because consumers aren't doing as many home renovation projects as usual. It is, however, easy in this economy to be an inexpensive burrito chain. Chipotle Mexican Grill has seen 7 consecutive quarters of double-digit earnings growth. Steve Ells is the company's founder and CEO, and he's with us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, as we cover the global economy on this show, I've sort of come to the conclusion, whether you look at clothing stores or car sales or restaurant sales, that we're in what you might call the Chipotle economy, which is that people want to feel like they're paying McDonald's prices, but they're getting Chili's.
Well, I've always made the argument that just because we're serving fast food doesn't mean it has to be a typical fast food experience. I mean, we've elevated traditional fast food, and it's certainly not a luxurious Michelin 3-star experience, and that's not the intent. The intent is that we're providing ingredients that were really only available at high-end restaurants or gourmet grocery stores just a few years ago. We're making these kinds of ingredients available to everybody.
But I do want to mention that when you get one of those big juicy burritos at Chipotle, it typically has more than 1,000 calories in it. Are you trying to get that down in any way?
I don't know that I would say it typically has more than 1,000 calories. I think it can range. We have a lot of customers who come in and want to eat light.
But they're missing out on the sour cream and the guac there.
Well, what's great about Chipotle is you can create exactly what you want, not only for taste, but for diet also.
You got into some trouble about a year ago for employing some illegal immigrants. Now you have more than, I think, 25,000 employees in your restaurants.
I think 35,000 approximately now.
More than 35,000. How do you make sure that they are legal workers?
Well, so, you know, we've always followed the letter of the law when hiring and actually going beyond what was required. Unfortunately, the system's not perfect, and we found ourselves in this situation where we were being audited, and some undocumented workers were found at Chipotle. Since then, we have started using what's called E-Verify, which is an extra level above and beyond that's not required, but that we're participating in to ensure that we have workers with proper documentation.
And it's obviously not just Chipotle, but do you think there's any way to ensure that all the workers are legal in the end, or will there always be some who are getting through the cracks there?
Well, it's tough to answer that. I mean, you know, whatever systems you have for anything, really, there are always going to be people who try to game the system. But I think that we're going above and beyond right now in two significant ways to ensure that we're complying with the immigration.
There's obviously a big taste for burgers all around the world, which is why McDonald's and Burger King have expanded worldwide. You are starting to expand in other countries, and I noticed that in London you're opening a few restaurants. Is the rest of the world ready for Mexican food?
You know, we just started European expansion, and we're going to focus on that for a while. But you also have to realize that our major growth opportunities are still in the United States, and that we're just seeding Europe right now. You know, Asia is certainly a possibility, but we don't have any definite plans for that right now.
Steve Ells is CEO of Chipotle. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Now to Thiensville, Wisconsin, where there was an all-you-can-eat fish fry the other day, David, but it was not quite all-you-can-eat enough for one 53-year-old man who was told after 12 pieces of fish that the restaurant had run out. He refused to pay his bill until the restaurant gave him another 8 pieces of fish to go. He returned a couple of days later, though, unsatisfied, with a picket sign to protest the restaurant's business practices and was arrested for disorderly conduct.
France has its first socialist president since the mid-1990s. François Hollande was sworn in today and promptly headed for Berlin to meet German leader Angela Merkel for the first time. The two power players in European politics have very different ideas about how to tackle the European financial mess, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us again to report from London.
She wants to tighten the purse strings. He wants to splurge. She's for austerity and he's for growth. But don't expect the clash of the titans when Merkel meets Hollande today. He's not quite titan material. Analyst Paul Vallée says in France, Hollande is known by his opponents as flambé.
It's a caramel pudding, which is known for its soft and flabby constituency.
And so he may seem when Angela Merkel gets her hands on him, says analyst Suda David Wilp. She says the German leader will use all her manipulative skills on her guest.
I think she's going to take time to assess him, his personality, and probably see how she can shape him and influence him.
The two do disagree. During the French election, Hollande called for Europe's new treaty promoting budget discipline to be renegotiated. But German lawmaker and Merkel ally Peter Altmaier says that cannot happen.
It was concluded by 25 countries, and that means you cannot renegotiate a treaty every time there is a national election in a country.
In the wake of his victory, there has been talk of Hollande leading a pro-growth, anti-austerity group of Eurozone countries, including Greece, Italy and Spain, and ganging up on Germany. Forget it, says Paul Vallée.
The Germans are going to be very firm on their policy principles because they have the money, they hold the cards here.
And, says Suda David Wilp, they take a dim view of European backsliders.
Germany has had its reform and belt tightening over the years, and the other countries should also line up to do the same in the European Union.
So when flambé arrives in Berlin, will the pudding wobble? Paul Vallée thinks he'll live up to his other nickname.
Some people have nicknamed him the eel for his capacity to wiggle out of a difficult spot with some kind of choice formula. I think we're probably going to see more eel than pudding in the next few weeks.
So more wiggle than wobble. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The national unemployment rate is still about 8%, but for some lucky graduates in a few fields, getting a job is almost guaranteed. A recent survey by the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce found that there's a handful of majors, including astrophysics, pharmacology, and actuarial science, where the unemployment rate is actually, no joke, 0%.
Here to speak with us for our Midday Extra is Paul Harrington from Drexel University's Center for Labor Markets and Policy. Good morning, Paul.
Morning.
So what are we talking about here? If you could get a degree in one of these fields, pretty much, you're going to get a job?
Well, what you'll find is that any of the really very math-intensive fields, computer science, physics, chemistry, you know, the demand out there is pretty strong, not because they're getting jobs as physicists. Quite the contrary, a lot of these youngsters are moving into information technology, computer science, computer engineering, sets of jobs. So their undergraduate preparation is really very solid. They're really academically rigorous programs, and there's a lot of demand in the IT field. So that's really where a lot of these youngsters are ending up.
Well, so does this also speak to the fact that there aren't enough of these people in these fields?
You know, certainly at the overall baccalaureate degree level, there's a lot of excess labor supply out there. You know, the unemployment rates aren't very good measures of what's going on in the college labor market, you know, because college grads trade what you might think of as underemployment or malemployment for unemployment. So that youngsters will take jobs, you know, working in a clerical job or a retail trade job or a cashier position rather than become unemployed. We estimate that somewhere around among all young college grads employed this year, somewhere between 35% and 40% would be sort of malemployed. So it's still a big underutilization problem there.
But I can hear the takeaway point already, which is if you're smart enough to get through those math courses and maybe some engineering courses, take them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's the demand for those for people with those really strong math proficiencies is, you know, is generally pretty good. When you look at the top 10 earnings major fields of study, they tend to be math dominated sets of fields. You know, actuarial sciences, business, finance. You know, certainly the physical sciences, engineering. And particularly this year, information technology, computer science, very strong.
Do the best fields for jobs change year by year, or have they been the scientific fields and mathematical fields for a while?
Oh, I think the science and math fields have dominated things for the last 30 years. Hmm. You know, the problem is it's hard to get new, you know, get incremental supply. That's why you see high schools and colleges, you know, with all these sort of what they call STEM initiatives, science, technology, engineering, and math initiatives, trying to increase the number of high school kids interested in those fields, the number of college kids majoring in engineering and science and the like, trying to get minority kids into those fields, women into those fields as well. So there's a big emphasis to try and get youngsters into those areas, but they're just tough majors, as you say, and it's tough to get an undergraduate or graduate degree in engineering and science. These are really hard fields.
It's interesting. I saw some data that suggests that people who are interested in these fields and have the wit and intelligence to get through them sometimes get discouraged because you get to these top programs and they don't make it easy for you.
No, the engineering, one of the things the engineers do, and sometimes they pride themselves on this, is they're very tough graders. You know, and you know, it's, you know, part of the reason why there's a big payoff at the end is because the supply of people coming out is somewhat limited. You know, at the end, the market is going to be, the value of the output is going to be determined by the supply and demand relationships. So as engineering programs are rigorous and tough, you know, it tends to constrain supply a little bit, and science programs are rigorous and tough. Similarly, supply gets constrained. So as a result, sometimes, you know, you end up with this lower unemployment problem and higher wages as a consequence.
I know we've heard President Obama talk about how we need to have more people majoring in math, science, and engineering and technology. But is enough being done at a national policy level to incentivize people to get into these fields and to put the support behind the teachers to make sure that they're able to produce more graduates?
Yeah, I mean, I think students vote with their feet across major fields of study at the margin. You know, where kids begin is with their interests, their aptitudes, and abilities. That's where they should begin in figuring out what the majors are. There's been a lot of effort trying to move kids into some of the STEM fields. It probably met with some success, but I think the market is going to pretty much overwhelm those kind of efforts.
Paul Harrington from Drexel University Center for Labor Markets and Policy. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally, no LOLs or OMGs in the yearbooks for some fifth graders in Georgia. Students in Birmingham Falls Elementary School have been told to take a pledge not to use acronyms or doodles or drawings when signing yearbooks. The problem is, Actually, Jeremy, I don't know what the problem is. It's something about, quote, respecting yearbooks, whatever that is. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says the class T-shirts were printed with the characters C-U-L-8-R.
See you later.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
So see you later, Jeremy.
See you later in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Dave Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.